Hi, everybody. Welcome back. We are rapidly nearing the end of the semester, much to my shock. I won't say dismay. So let's see what we've got. I ran over a little bit last time, meaning that there's a topic that I actually needed to cover that I didn't get to. So I will get to that, and I'll try to get through today's lecture as well. Is Kyle Sterling here? So I still don't see you on anything online. Is that true?
Really?
Yeah.
Did you get my email? Like, I never got a response.
Then no.
No? All right, I guess I'll...
So I can't reach you and you can't reach me, which is a little awkward.
Email,
next time you email me, CC like the TAs and stuff too, because that way at least somebody will know what's going on. All right. Let's see. Oh, so I have a sample final almost ready to hand out. That I was reminded at the end of class last time that was going to be needed very soon. And I have one slot left that I don't have a good question for. I don't like the one I used last year. So if anybody has an idea of something that we've worked on in the second half of the semester that would be interesting, fun to have on the test, let me know. Anything that you liked, problems that you liked. I mean, obviously I've got a bunch already, but I'm open to ideas. Failing ideas, I'll just make something up on my own, and I'll probably think it's too easy, so I'll make it harder. But, you know, you do what you want. I'm listening. All right, I'll let you think about that a bit, and I'll ask next time, too. But I might have to leave that one blank on the sample for now, which is not ideal.
But I'd like to show you what all the questions are.
Okay, all right. So, in fact, I think I've got one clicker question. Yeah, I've only got one clicker question, and it's on something that we don't know how to do yet. So I need to teach you this thing, and then I'm going to ask you a clicker question about it. So last time we talked about encoding messages in bits, and we talked about the fact that different encodings can lead to different length messages, and what compression is, when a file gets compressed, is basically it gets rewritten in a way that captures the same information, but with fewer bits, so a more compact encoding. And we talked about the Gettysburg Address as an example of something we can encode in a bunch of different ways, but some of them were much more compact than others. Huffman coding in particular was the optimal code given that every letter was going to get its own code. And I showed you how to do it in the large, but what we're going to do is we're going to practice on some very small words. We're going to come up with Huffman codes that just work for just a small set of characters. And then you can see how many bits it takes to encode that message in the code that you in the encoding that we create. So I did step through this last time. So at least in principle, you should be able to do this. But in practice, I suspect you need at least one more time and people asking questions and knowing that you're about to have to do this on your own. So here's the game. We're gonna make up a code for all the letters in the word muffin mix. Different questions will involve different words, but muffin mix is the one that I chose to introduce. And so we need a code for the M, the U, the F, the I, and so forth, so that when we go and write out muffin mix by putting the code for M next to the code for U, next to the code for F, and then the code for F again, that the total number of bits that's going to take is going to be as small as possible. All right, so let me show you how to do that. So here are the steps. First step is we're going to just write down the letters and how often each of them occurs. Because, you know, the letter M appears in there twice, the letter X only once. So if we have a choice about which one to make long and which one to make short, we're going to want the M to be as short as possible. And the X can be a bit bigger because it's only going to get counted once. So we've got an M, a U, an F, an I, let's see, a second F, one M, one U, one F, another F, an I, an N, an M, an I, and an X. Okay? So I'm just tallying up. There's two M's, one U, two F's, one I, one N, and one X. Okay? So now what we're going to do is we're going to, this is the rule. This is how Huffman codes are made, and I mentioned this last time. We're going to take, of all the groups that we've got, and at the moment there's just one group per letter, take the two smallest groups and merge them to make a bigger group. So the size of a group is the count. So what are the two smallest groups that we've got at the moment? U has a count of one, N has a count of one, and X has a count of one. Now we can choose which two to merge together. They're all the same size. It's not going to ultimately matter in the encoding. But we have to choose something. So I'll choose the U and the N, say. So we've got a U and an N, and we're going to merge them together to form one group. And the size of that group is 2, because there was one on the U and one on the N. Okay, so we've taken care of the U, and we've taken care of the N. So now the groups are, the ones that we're done with aren't there anymore. So we've got an M for 2, an F for 2, an I for 2, an X for 1, and a UN that has size 2. Okay, so what are the two smallest things that we've got? Well, we know one of them has to be X, because that's size 1. We can merge that with anything that's size 2. So let's merge it with the I. So we've got X, which is size 1, and I, which is size 2, and we're going to merge them together in a single group. And what's the size of this group now?
3.
3. It's got a 2 and a 1, so it's 3. All right. Now we're left with one fewer group than we had before. There's a group of size 2 with M, 2 with F, 2 with U and N together, and 3 with I and X together. So we need to merge the two smallest ones together. What do we got? We have a choice again. Let's merge the M with the UN. So this was an M that was size 2. We're merging it with the UN, which was size 2, to make a UNM group of size 4. All right, so what are we left with now? We've got F, which is size 2, IX, which is size 3, and UNM, University of New Mexico, which is size 4. So what are the two smallest? This is the first time that there's just one right answer. F is one of them, and the IX is the other, right? So we're going to take F, which is size 2, so we're done with it over here, and we're going to merge it with the IX group, which is size 3, to get a group of size 5. All right, how many groups are we left with?
2.
2. What do? We merge them. Gesundheit.
To get a group of size 9.
Now, there should have been 9 letters in Muffin Mix if we did this right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay, that's relief. And just as a reminder, it has IX at the end, which is the Roman numeral for 9. Anyway, it's true, it's just not relevant. All right, so this is, now we're done. This is our code. Okay, how is this our code? Well, if we're going to label each of the branches, zeros to the left and ones to the right. So this is a 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1. All right. So reading down the tree, we can get the code for any letter we want. So the code, so let's write out the code for all our letters. What is M? M is 1, 1. Okay, we went to the right and to the right. U is 1, 0, 0. F is 0, 0. I is 0, 1, 0. N is 0, 0, 1, and X is 0, 1, 1. So if we did this right, I think we did, each of the letters should have its own code. Yes?
Isn't N 1, 0, 1?
1, 0, 1. If we did this right, and we didn't,
put 0, 0, 1. Right.
0, 0, 1 is not a valid code. Right, 0, 0 gives us an F, and then there's a 1 hanging off the end of it. So this was 0, no, sorry, 1, 0, 1. Good. If we did this right, which may be the second time we did, everybody should have its own code, and they should be, and messages should be encodable and decodable and so forth. So if we were going to write, let's just pick a word like if. If we wanted to write if in this new code, we would take the code for I, which is 0, 1, 0, and we stick after it the code for F, which is 0, 0, and those 5 bits together spell out if. Okay? Let's see, can I make up another one? All right, here's a code. I'll raise it up after I write it. So what is that? Oh, you got it. How awkward. All right, 001, 001, 01. What does that spell?
Fun.
What's that?
Fun.
Fun. This is F U N. All right? So you should be able to go, if I give you a tree, you should be able to encode and decode things. If I give you the, you know, the tree and the bits, you should be able to write out the word. If I give you the tree and the word, you should be able to write out the bits. But the last thing to be able to do, and this is what I'm going to do a clicker question on in a moment, is muffin mix altogether, how long is that if we write it in the code? So muffin mix is going to have two M's, each of which is size 2. So there's going to be 4 bits that encode M's, right? 2 bits for the first M and 2 bits for the second M. There's 1 3-bit code for U, that's 3. There's 2 2-bit codes for F. There's 2 3-bit codes for I. There's 1 3-bit code for N. And 1 3-bit code for X. For a total of 7, 11, 17, 20, 23. So we made a code specifically for encoding muffin mix, a Huffman code for that. And when we went to write out the word muffin mix in the code that we made, which is the minimal length code for muffin mix, it was 23 bits. All right, so if I asked you how many bits would it take to write muffin mix in the code that you get when you process muffin mix, the answer would be 23. Now, there's a couple interesting things to know here. The code itself is not unique. Right? We could have, there were a couple times when we had choices. There were 3 different things of size 1, and we could have merged any pair of them. Different ways of merging will give you a different code. But the wicked cool thing is that you always get the same number of total bits. No matter how you made the choices along the way, if you did everything right, 23 is going to be a constant for muffin mix. So generally, because I don't really care about how you come up with the code in between, as long as you do it right, I don't have to check every different possible code. I'm going to ask you questions like, how many total bits does it end up being? Because there's only one right answer for that. All right, any questions before you do one on your own? The question that I always get is, why did you merge the two, you know, why did you merge U and N first? And the answer was, it didn't matter. I had to choose two of the smallest groups, and there was 3 of them. Any 2 will do. Why is the U to the left of the N instead of the other way? Doesn't matter. You'll get a different code, but it'll still have the same compression factor. So a lot of these choices are arbitrary. But you always have to merge the 2 smallest groups. As long as you do that, you end up getting the right answer. All right? Good to go? Okay, all right. So the word is Adriana Lima. What's that? Does anybody know who that is? I don't know if you've heard who that is. It's a what? It's a model? Oh, I see. So I go to Google and I'm like, what's a popular search in Google? And I get answers like that. Regardless, I liked it because it had a lot of repeated letters. If there's no repeated letters, this whole process is really boring. long do you think you need?
A while.
I don't know that we can do a while. Maybe I'll go another 15 seconds and then I'll talk you through it. Steady progress.
Yeah.
All right, carry on. If you click, just to click, and you work out the right answer, just click over it. Just put in the answer you wanted. Oh, wow, it's all over the thing. See what we get. So the word is Adriana Lima. We're going to count up the number of times each of the unique letters appears. We've got one A, one D, one R, one I, another A, an N, another A, an L, an I, an M, and an A. Total of four A's. All right, now we're going to start merging groups together. So we take two of the small groups, so D and R. So I'll start low on the board. Each of them has one. Okay? We're done our first merging. Second merging. Oh, we didn't merge it. There we go. All right. Second merging, we need to take two of the smallest groups. There's still two more ones. So we'll take N and L, merge them together. Okay? Now we need two of the smallest groups. We've got a 2, a 2, a 1, a 2, and a 4. So it's going to be a 1 with one of the 2s. So let's put M along with this group. Okay, handled that. Now we've got a 2, a 3, a 2, and a 4. So the two 2s have to go together. So I is a 2. It goes along with this other group to become a 4. We're done with that. All right, now we've got a 3, a 4, and a 4. So the 3 is going to have to get merged with one of the 4s. So let's put it with
MDR.
MDR is the 3, and that needs to go with one of the other ones. So I'll just put it with A. For 7, and now we're just left. Oh, this is done. So now we're left with just these two groups that make an 11, and we're done. All right, so there should be 11 letters in her name. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Okay? There are other trees that would have been just as good. So don't panic. I didn't hear any panics. It actually makes me nervous. All right, now we have to ask for each of the letters, how long is the code? So A has a code of length 2. D has a code of length 1, 2, 3, 4. R has a code of length 1, 2, 3, 4. I has a code of length 2. N has a code of length 1, 2, 3. L has a code of length 1, 2, 3. And M has a code of length 1, 2, 3. All right, so that's how long each of the codes are. We could write down what they are. Like the code for I would be 1, 1, which is kind of uninteresting. But all of them have codes, and they all have various, whatever their lengths are. What's the total number of bits we need to write down the whole name? Well, we're going to write A down 4 times, and each of those is 2 bits. So we've got 8 for that. The D, there's only one of them, but it's 4 bits long. The R, one that's 4 bits long. The I, 2, each of which are 2 bits long. N, 3 bits. L, 3 bits. And M, 3 bits. For a total of, this is 9. This is 12. These guys together are 20, so the total is 29. No hands or anything, no mumbling, no angry, no happy. Quiet. So these half the class didn't put that. Yes?
Where did you get the second group of numbers?
Where did I get the second group of numbers? Oh, so this group was the tallies. That's the first group of numbers. The second group is I went for each of the codes. I said, R, how long is the code for R in this tree that we built? Well, starting at the root, it's a 0, 1, 1, 1. That's the code for R, so it's 4 bits long. So I wrote down 4 in the second column. So this was the count, or the frequency. This was the bit length. And then this is the product of those two. And then I sum those up to get the total length. But the other thing I could have done is actually written down her name in this bit code and counted the bits. But it would have given me the same answer and it would have taken longer and more error prone. So I just shortcutted it and I said, "Or there's one D in her name and the code that we made has 4 bits long for the D, so the total bits assigned to D are 4. Yes?
But how do you determine whether a value is either a 1 or a 0?
Doesn't matter. You don't even have to be consistent. As long as it's the case that each time there's a branch, one of those branches is a 0 and one is a 1. What I've been doing, just so that I don't get myself confused, is make the left branch as zeros and the right branch as 1s. Yeah, but you can imagine if you flipped all the zeros and 1s to be the opposite of what they are, the length of the code wouldn't change. Just the actual numbers would change. Now, if you actually want to compress a file like this, say something a lot longer than just the name of a supermodel, if I have a name of a whole lot of supermodels, then if I want to transmit it to you compressed, I have to do 2 things. I have to send you the message, but I also have to send you the table that says the letter A is going to be encoded as 0, 0. The letter D is going to be encoded as 0, 1, 1, no, sorry, 0, 1, 1, 0. 0, 1, 1, 0, yes. So I have to send this table along with it, which sounds like it would be kind of a pain, but if the message is really long, we're talking, you know, like a megabyte or something like that, this little table in the beginning is insignificant. You don't have to worry about that at all. When we're talking about the name, you know, one small name with just 11 characters, it's much more of a big deal. But I don't want you to encode very long messages because you can't do that by hand. Okay, all right? Does that kind of make sense? We'll do another one in the beginning next time. So you can nail this down, but there'll be one on the sample final and then one will be in the actual final. All right, good. So if you guys are good, then I'm going to move on. All right, I'm going to move on. No, not chapter 5. Trying to wrap up chapter 6, which I think I'm just going to say a few more words about. And then we can get into 7. So just the last few things I was going to talk about. Now that we've gone through Huffman coding, We can figure out how long something is in Huffman codes. There are other kinds of code. Another kind of code is, instead of just trying to make it as small as possible, to actually make it error detecting. And what that means is, if I'm trying to send you a message that consists of a whole bunch of ones and zeros, there's lots of things that can happen in the process. You can mishear a zero as a one, or vice versa. You can not hear it at all, right? So I go 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, and you weren't sure exactly how many bits were even in that message. An error detecting code is a code that, assuming you hear all the bits, but you might not have heard them all correctly, at the end, if you haven't heard too many things wrong, it will say to you, hey, something's not right. This message that you sent me is garbled in some way. Now, we won't go into how you do that in detail, but we actually looked at an example in the very beginning of the semester that has a property like this. It wasn't a series of bits, but I give you a series of digits. And at the end of that, if you misheard one of the digits, you could actually fill it in. Do you remember what that was?
The UPC codes.
Yeah, the UPC codes are error detecting, right? They have the property that if I turn one of the digits into something else at random, you don't know what the message was, but you can tell something's wrong because the check bit doesn't add up. So if you write that out in bits, you get an error detecting coding. There's also error correcting codes, which are really neat. So you send a message in such a way that not only can you tell if something's been garbled, but you can figure out what was garbled, and you can correct it to what it should have been. So it's like a message that actually kind of fixes itself. And that's really important if you're doing things like, this gets used, for example, in sending messages from deep space probes. So you send, you have some thing that's out, you know, around Pluto or thereabouts, and it's sending us messages back. They can't send those messages very loud, because it takes a lot of energy, so they kind of whisper them at Earth, and they travel many, many millions of miles, and on the way, they might have gotten a little bit corrupted or misheard. These error correcting codes, once you have an approximation of the message, something that's there but maybe a little bit garbled, it can actually get cleaned up and the original message can be recovered. That's pretty cool. There's also, when you run things like zip, winzip, and things like that, they actually do multiple character encoding, multiple character compression. So it takes common sequences of letters and compresses them into their own codes. So instead of just a special short code for T, H, and E, when T, H, and E appear together, which actually happens very often in English, that gets its own special magic short code. So you can get, when you do that, you can start getting closer and closer to what's called Shannon's entropy, which is the smallest that you can compress a message before it basically has to lose information. Yeah, I was going to do a demo of that, but I don't think I have time. But what's interesting about compressed messages is the more you compress something, the more the bits start to look completely random. A message that consists of truly random bits, basically like static on a TV screen, do they have that anymore? In the old days, there used to be static that you could get on your TV screen if you tuned into a bad channel. That kind of random, no pattern flickering and so forth contains the most possible information. It's very hard to compress static because there's so much going on. Whereas an image of a person or something, you can notice that there's big swaths that are all the same color, and there's some very common combinations of colors. You can find ways of compressing that down to a lot fewer bits. But static, it's all information. It's useful information, but it's information. So I could show you, or I could encourage you on your own. If you watch TV on cable systems these days, they do various kinds of compression so your video signal is as small as possible. You're getting as much of digital information in as you can. Certain kinds of changes of scene from one kind of picture to another kind of picture don't compress well. And so you get these weird visual artifacts. So I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but sometimes you'll see like a weird flash or like an after image of something on the screen. It goes away briefly and you wonder whether it was there at all. But it was really there, and it's an artifact of the video compression that's being done. And so I have some examples of that, but they don't always come out very well. But certainly something that you should be, you can look for. And you can say, oh, I know why they do that. They're trying to send as few bits as possible to get the video signal out. Something that's very closely related and is talked about in the chapter to encoding is encryption. The idea that we're going to represent a message not just in terms of bits that make it really easy to figure out what they are, but exactly the opposite. That we're going to send the message in a way that makes it really hard to figure out what the original message was.
And so it turns out that a lot of the same ideas that are important for encoding and compression are also very important for encryption as well. All right, so if you have any questions about those kinds of things, I would be happy to say more. But in the interest of time, I think I'm going to dive in to chapter 7. If we get through chapter 7 really well, I'll probably, well, we'll see what happens. All right, so chapter 7 is about parallel computation. So the idea of actually using multiple computers to solve a problem faster than a single computer. Why is this so important? Well, we kind of like fast computers. It turns out to be really nice if you can buy one device and it can do many, many things. And it can do them all efficiently and fast, and they can solve the problems, and they can play your music, and they can show your images, and they can transmit stuff. It's all great. And so, in fact, engineers, dating back at least since the 1970s, have been doing their darndest to keep us fed with as much speed as we could make use of. This is a plot of something called Moore's Law. The idea here is the x-axis is the year, and the y-axis is a computer chip in that year, how many transistors were on it? How many actual computing components do they fit on a chip? So back in the 70s, it was like 1,000 or so, which seemed like a lot. It was enough to make a computer, but it wasn't enough to make a super powerful computer. What's been happening is basically year and a half, the number of transistors that engineers can fit on a single chip has doubled. And it's continued to double all the way up, at least this plot goes until 2005. And in fact, it actually is speeding up. The rate at which they're doubling is getting shorter. So you have to keep in mind that the y-axis here is the number of transistors, but it's on a log scale. It's 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, 1,000,000, 10,000,000, 100,000,000, 1,000,000,000. So presumably, if you extrapolate this up to the current year, we're off past 1,000,000,000 now. And I think that's actually true. I think we're well over 1,000,000,000 transistors on a single computer chip. And what the number of transistors turns out to translate to, because the way that they're making more transistors on a chip is by making them smaller. So information is traveling faster on the chip, because information travels at the speed of light. So if you shrink the size of the chip by a factor of half, information is arriving at its destination twice as fast. So this is really cool, and this is sort of part of the reason why computers these days can do these incredible things that just weren't even conceivable a couple years ago. They're twice as powerful as they were a year and a half ago, which is remarkable. Now, what's the problem with this? Well, the problem with this is eventually, it seems like you can just keep going up and up, right? But the thing is that once you get to really, really, really tiny transistors, quantum mechanics kicks in. And in our mechanical world, you have objects and they can bounce off each other and they have velocity and stuff like that. At the very, very, very small scale in physics, you don't have certainty anymore. Things are kind of both one and zero at the same time with different probabilities depending on how you look at it. And so once we get to this really tiny, tiny, tiny scale, you can't encode digital information very well, because you make it a one and then it sort of maybe it's a zero later. And so information gets lost in the process of doing that. And so even though we're getting smaller and smaller and faster computers, people extrapolate, some of the people who study this sort of thing extrapolate that by the year 2010 or maybe 2020, they won't be able to make things any smaller. The smaller it gets at that point, the more information is lost and you can't really do computation anymore. You can't make an AND gate when it just may randomly turn into something else. So at that point, you hit a limit. You can't make it any faster, at least in the way that we think about computers now. So one way of trying to get around this and continue to deliver faster and faster computers is not to make an individual computer smaller and faster, but to have more and more computers working on the same problem at the same time, which is not a bad idea. But it turned out to be difficult in lots of different ways. So some people have actually been successful at this. This is a guy named Philip, we'll call him Philip E. And he is posing here in front of a computer that looks wicked cool, doesn't it? Do you see this, the computer behind him? It's like 8 black boxes that are all kind of fused together, and there's red flashing lights on the side of it. They actually used this computer in the movie Jurassic Park because they wanted something that looked really cool. So this is a really cool looking computer. In fact, this computer, the circuitry in it was designed by Danny Hillis, the guy who wrote the book that we've been using.
And that's one of his major claims to fame. His PhD dissertation was the design of this computer. When he graduated, he went off and found some people to fund him, and they built this computer and they sold it. And it consists of 65,000 separate processors all working together, which is a really neat idea. Unfortunately, the processors themselves were very, very weak. They only processed a single bit of information at a time, whereas modern processors can do 64 or 128 bits at a time. They're doing a lot more each cycle. So they were very slow, very dumb processors, but there were 65,000 of them. So surely there are certain things that you can do that way things you can do with that you wouldn't be able to do with a regular computer. What this guy was able to do is do fluid dynamics calculations, which is what you need to do things like weather prediction. If you try to do weather prediction, you want to model the air as being a kind of a fluid that's flowing over the surface of the Earth, and that's kind of like wind. And so he took the whole ocean and broke it up into little squares and assigned a single processor to each of those squares and then processed the information about what was happening with the flow of the liquids. So he won a big award, and that's really cool. But here's the scary thing. So he did this in 1989. 17 years later, like the kind of computers that you could get now or a year or so ago, let's see, computers were themselves about 2,000 times faster. So whereas here, he had... he could do 3.1 billion operations per second by getting all these very weak computers to all work together. Now, with just silly old computer you can get at the mall, you've got almost the same amount, 2.5 billion cycles per second. So the processing power of just stuff you can buy has gone up. I mean, those computers were multiple millions of dollars. Very few centers could get them. A couple computer science departments got them. I think American Express got one and the military got one. But nobody else could afford them. But now, now everybody can afford almost that same amount of computing power. So this idea of so I wanted to point out two things here. One is that you can get, even with very weak processors, you can get a tremendous speed up if you let them work together in parallel. The other thing to point out is that computers are a heck of a lot faster than they used to be, so that has become less important. But it's going to become important again as we reach fundamental physics, limits of physics. You can think of what Google is a giant supercomputer. They won't actually tell people how many computers they have, but somebody said that if you look at when they went IPO, when they went public, they had to give people lots of information about their financial inputs and outputs. And based on that, you could kind of extrapolate and say that there's probably about 300,000 computers, maybe a bit more, maybe a bit less, and it's probably changed since they've gone IPO. But we're talking on the order of hundreds of thousands of computers working together. So the connection machine, 65,000 processor, that's a lot. These are modern computers, and there's way more of them, like a factor of 10 more computers. So we're talking about immense power computation. Maybe it's 100,000, maybe it's 500,000, but it's a lot. So you can get a lot more processing power out of the Google computer than you can out of the connection machine. But it turns out that it's actually kind of tricky to take advantage of this, because it seems like some problems are what they call inherently sequential. There are problems that it's very hard to imagine breaking them up into pieces, giving them out to a whole bunch of different processors to work on together, and then merging the answers back together. So just in case it's not obvious to you, think about the idea of like writing a book. So the last Harry Potter book took about 2 years for J.K. Rowling to write. And the reason that I remember that is because my kids, I think, were waiting the entire time, just sitting there, So that was long. And it would be nice if they could make that faster, right? They had plenty of money. The publisher had tons of money. Other books had been so successful. So why didn't they just, let's see. Well, it's about, how many pages long? Do I have it up there? Say about 600 pages long. You can get a person to write a page of text in a day, right? So why not you just hire 600 authors, pay them less than it would take to get the Harry Potter author going, and have them all write the one page, and then you glue them together and you have your book. I don't know why they didn't do that. Well, the reason that they didn't do that is to make something like a book requires not just 600 pages of text, but there's coordination between the pages. They actually kind of make sense when you put them all together. So you can't just write them all separately and expect they're going to fit. You have to think about, well, this page has some information on it that's going to also matter later in the book. In fact, one of the reasons that the books are so enjoyable is because they introduce ideas, or she introduces ideas in kind of a clever way that only later you discover what it really means. And so there's these threads that go through the entire text. So you can't just break it up, break a problem up into separate pieces and solve them all in parallel to get things to be sped up. You have to worry about coordination as well. So there's a concrete example. I think this comes from the textbook, Hillis's book, that says, well, if you're going to try to paint a really, really long fence, you might break it up into subtasks, like one person's job is opening up the paint cans, one person's job is getting the surfaces ready to be painted, another person does the painting, and another person does the brushes. That's four people, and so you're doing it faster than if a person was doing it alone. But what he points out is that this actually doesn't lead to the fence getting painted very much faster. What you really want to do is take the very, very long fence and assign a person to each segment of fence and have each person do all those steps. So you give the person a sander, cleaning materials, paint, and a brush, and you have that person paint just a segment of the fence. So now, no matter how long the fence is, if you double the length of the fence, that's okay. Just double the number of people, and you still get it done in the same amount of time. So that's the kind of good parallelism, because you can actually have everybody doing. In fact, you can have everybody doing the same thing at the same time, but they're all working on different data. They're all working a different part of the fence. So Hillis introduced in his thesis this concept of data parallelism as opposed to instruction parallelism. Instruction parallelism says you have separate processors and you give them all different things to do. Data parallelism says you have a whole bunch of processors and they all do the same thing, but they do them on different pieces of the problem. And he said that's the more scalable kind of parallelism. All right, so we're going to try, let's do a demo. All right. So I want everybody to think of a phone number either your phone number or a phone number that you have memorized. If you have multiple phone numbers, just pick one. Just have a phone number in your head. Okay, ready? And so I would like to know whether anyone has a telephone number that has two or more fives in it. So one way I can do this is, don't follow the instructions quite yet. One way I can do this, if I were a sequential computer, I could just go through and say, do you have two or more fives in your phone number? No, do you? No, do you? You do. Okay, so now we're done. All right, we'll try three or more fives. Okay, you said no. How about you? Three or more? No, three or more? Three or more? If we double the number of people, how long is the time going to be? If it takes me 5 minutes to do everybody, we double the people, it'll take 10 minutes, right? It's good. It's not going to scale very well. It's going to be O of N if there's N people in the class. We have to go and ask everybody individually. So let's not do this. Let's take advantage of parallelism. So what we're going to do is think of the answer yourself. And if the answer is yes, you have three or more fives, because two or more fives is too easy, apparently. Three or more fives in the phone number, raise your hand. Ready? Go. All right, processing done. So the answer is yes. We have at least two. How many fives? Three. Nobody with four? Four or more fives? 555555. That would be 7 fives. Then you can be on TV. Apparently, everybody on TV seems to have numbers that start with 555. All right, so that was faster, right? That was a lot faster than actually going through and doing the calculation separately. It would have been even slower if instead of me asking each person individually for you to actually tell me the phone number, I write it down and then I answer the question for myself. That would have taken forever. But instead, I let you work on your own data and just send me one bit of information, hand up or hand down. And because now, how come I can get that answer fast? It's because the visual system allows me to do basically a giant or. I can very quickly answer the question, does anyone have a hand up? Because, I don't know, our visual systems just let us do that. They notice sudden changes in motion. Okay. Now, if you were marking it by, for example, like tapping your foot, no, I wouldn't be able to see that at all. But like if you close your left eye and right, you close your right eye. No, sorry. Yes, you close your left eye. No, you close your right eye. Then I would have still had to have gone through and checked everybody individually. But hand going up, boom, I can detect that really fast. So certain operations, we can get the answer back really, really quickly. So to point this out in terms of big O, like we've been talking about, the sequential approach is I have to loop through and test every single one of them, and that's going to be big O of N. So if there's N in the list, and the answer is no, I'm going to have to check everybody to find that out. So it grows with the size of the list N. If we have some giant parallel computer and some kind of connection matrix that lets them the answers come together, we can actually do this in logarithmic time. So big O of log N, if there's N processors. Which is essentially constant. It's almost like right away I get the answer.
So let me show you what this looks like in Scratch. Because it turns out Scratch isn't really parallel, but you can fake it. You can actually make something that looks very parallel. In fact,
I intend to demo.
This is parallel cats. All right, so I've got a bunch of cats. I don't even know how many there are, but there's a lot. And when I click on a cat, it turns green. And I want to answer the question, how many green cats are there? All right, so I can click on a couple of them. And how do I actually have to get this question answered? Well, how do I do this? This, I have to hit a button. I have to hit like C or something. I didn't count. All right, so I did three of them. Oh, there it goes. Okay, so green count is three. All right, so I click on four of them. Green count is four. I'll unclick these two guys. That's two, all right. First is a sequential approach where it actually has to run through an array. All right, so let me show you what the code looks like in these two cases. So what I do is, in the sequential approach, I have to have an array of cat costumes. And so, to look on the left here, so this is the same kind of loop notation we've been using. We're going to have a variable called green count, which is going to count up the number of green cats. We're going to start off item one. Yeah, that should be one, actually, not zero. And then I'm going to repeat once for each of the cats that are out there. If the cat's costume is costume number two, the green one, then I'm going to add one to my count, and then I'm going to go back into the loop. So what this loop does is it's going to ask each cat individually, are you green, are you green, are you green, are you green? And if every time it gets a yes, it increases its count. And when it's done, when it's gone through all the cats, then green count has exactly the number of green costumes. Okay, so that's the sequential approach, and that grows. It's like O of N. It's going to be, if there's N cats, it takes basically N time to go all the way through that list. But let's look at this other one. This is a different kind of idea. Now, each cat has its own script. Here's the script for cat number 22. Each time I click on it, it changes costume. But it's waiting around to hear the message green check. And when it hears it, it asks whether its costume is costume 2, the green costume. And if it is, it adds one to the count. So it just cares about itself. If it's asked, hey, help me count up the green costumes, and it's wearing green, it increases the count by one. But they all have that. If you look at cat number one, it's the same exact script. So all the cats are just sitting there waiting for the chance to do the count. And there's a script at the very top that says when I hit the C button, it sets the green count to zero, and then it broadcasts to everybody, green check! So it's just, hey cats, green check. Now they all add one to the count if they're green, and it all just happens. Basically, that's it. There's no looping. There's no repetition. It's that each cat is responsible for its own count. So that's more or less what we just did with the phone number thing, right? So the two possibilities are the O of N that involves looping through everybody, and the other one that said, no, you do it yourself. Just give me the answer, and I'll be able to tally up the answers really quickly. All right, so this is a very simple example. You don't really want to do cat costume counting. But it actually illustrates two really important data parallel operations that are absolutely critical to how Google does what it does. The way that they're usually formalized is in terms of two operations called map and reduce. So map basically says, I've got this data, and I give it out to a bunch of processors, and I tell everybody what they need to do with their own data. That's the map part. I map the data out over a big range. Then reduce says, all right, now everybody report your answers back to me, and it all comes trickling back. That's the reduction. So I ask a big question to a bunch of people. You answer it for your own piece of the data, and then the reduce operation brings it all back so we have an answer for the whole group. So in the cat example, everybody was asked, are you wearing green? Add one to the count if you are. And the reduce was that summon. When we did the phone number question, I asked the question out to everybody, you thought of your own number, and then the reduce operation was looking to see whether your hands came up.
All right. So a lot of what Google does, they actually express it in terms of map and reduce. They take a computation that they need to do, they give it out to some fraction of their thousands and thousands of computers, they have all those computers do whatever piece of the calculation they need to, and then the information is all sent back to whoever asked for it to get the final answer. So as a concrete example, let me show you something that's sort of cool. I don't know if you've not done this, it's sort of intriguing in its own way. It's a thing called hot trends. So you can go onto Google and ask it, basically, what are some of the more interesting queries lately? What are queries that are suddenly getting hot? They're suddenly being asked much more often than they used to be asked. So then I'll say what it is, and then we'll talk about how it is that they actually compute this, or roughly. So this is, I did this, I don't know, a couple days ago, November 5th. That was a long time ago. Yes, right, we're in December now. Huh, all right. Anyway, I asked it, what are the hot topics right now? And it gave me back a long list, and I took the top 10 and showed them to you. So one is Siri Pinter. Does anybody know what that is? So these are things that are just about to become exciting to some group of people anyway. But most of them I didn't recognize. I was able to look up a few. All right, so this was the number one rising thing very recently. Quinoa pasta? Does that mean anything to anyone? Ann Coulter broken jaw. Does anybody know what that's referring to? Yes, no. Anybody?
She's a writer.
She's a writer, that's correct. No, that's not correct. I mean, that may be correct, but that's not why it was suddenly very popular. People have wanted that for maybe a while, but that's not... What happened is she actually broke her jaw. She fell down and got hurt. And so this was sort of spreading through the blogosphere, people writing about it in various ways. And so a lot of people followed up by asking queries to Google about it. And so all of a sudden this phrase, which basically never appeared as a query, was getting very frequent. So they were seeing more and more queries for this. Charlie Brown Thanksgiving. It's a TV special. I guess people were wondering about it. How to deal. So I wasn't sure what that was. But I did find the plot for it. So if you look, what happens is through November, oh no, this is not November 5th, this is later, because November 25th it was basically unheard of, and then all of a sudden around noontime on the 25th, suddenly people were getting very excited about this. So does anybody know what it's referring to?
It's a movie.
It's a movie, yeah. It was a very popular book, I think, first, right? And so they were making it into a movie. And so... I guess they announced that it was going to be a movie recently? Or is it an old movie or is it a recent movie? So why all of a sudden would people be talking about this? What's that?
Maybe it was on TV.
Maybe it was on TV, maybe. Is it anything like the vampire movie?
Mm-hmm.
Is it would appeal to the same group? No, all right, then we don't know. All right. Gravitas, which looks like a misspelling of gravitas. I don't know. Naughty Gilligan's Island. And this ain't Gilligan's Island. So apparently it was a newly released porn video that was getting a tremendous amount of play on the queries. It's sort of embarrassing, actually. Martha Stewart Thanksgiving was suddenly on the rise, and cashback.com. I think they had just started to advertise very frequently on TV, and so people were starting to get to know about it. So these are the things that they detected as being very common. And the thing is that they get millions of queries all the time. And so you can't just say, oh, hey, here's that query again. You have to look at all the millions of queries laid out in front of you and group them together to try to figure out if something is more frequent than it used to be. And the way they do this is with MapReduce. They actually have a whole bunch of computers. They take the flow of queries that have been coming in. They gather them together. They give them out to a bunch of computers. And then they ask them to do statistics on them. Like, they might give one computer all the queries that start with A and another one all the ones that start with B, but then they say, within your group, find things that have been changing very rapidly. So all the computers do that calculation separately, and then the information trickles back to the computer that asked for it, and then they post it up on the web. So these are the way that they actually build the Google index is the same idea as this, but I thought this was a little bit more palatable. Not palatable, but palpable, I guess. So I don't know if you guys have noticed this, but they've actually changed their front page in a little bit lately. So
Do you notice that it's got the auto-completion stuff going? Do you know that that's different than it used to be? I didn't see an announcement about this, but I noticed. It used to be that you start typing, and it does auto-completion for other queries that you've typed in the past.
Yeah.
That's not what it's doing anymore. It's actually doing queries that anyone in the world has typed in the past. Which is really kind of creepy, right? So, well, who's this Adrian? So if we type Adrian, yeah, look at that. It auto-completed to that. It thinks that the most common query that starts with those letters is Adriana Lima. I swear I don't know what that is. If you type in, say, Michael Littman. Now, I noticed this and I said, crap, people are querying me. I hope my hair is... But my spouse doesn't come up. So Lisa Littman. Yeah, so it's not just any possible combination of words. It's actually doing some kind of statistics on queries that people actually type. I don't know what else to type. What about reduction? There it is, number two, right after reductil. What's reductil? What's that?
It had more results.
Yeah, so it's interesting. You can see that it's not sorted by... it's actually alphabetical, right? It's sorted by alphabetical. But what causes it to pop up is not the number of hits that it would generate, but the number of times people have been querying it, right? So there's two sources. Google has two sources of information. There's the web pages that they scrape by visiting web pages. Then there's the queries that people actually log into Google and type. And they have two different sets of statistics on those things. There's words that are used very often on web pages that nobody types. There's words that people type a lot that maybe don't appear on very many web pages. So this is the only time that I've seen them actually give us some kind of access to their queries. And that's one thing that anybody can spider the web, though it's hard to do it as well as they do. But only Google has that kind of information. Interestingly, I typed GOG and it came up with Google. Goggle. No, not Google. Goggle. All right, anyway. All right, and the only way that they can pull all this off is by making really smart use of lots and lots of computers. So the way that they actually build the index itself, it takes up 20 terabytes. What's a terabyte? A terabyte is 1,000 gigabytes. What's a gigabyte? That's 1,000 megabytes. What's a megabyte? That's 1,000... kilobytes. What's 1,000 kilobytes? 1,000 bytes. So 1,000 times 20 is the amount of information that they're working on when they build their index. They need to build the index so that when you type a word, they can very instantly, or just instantly, tell you back what the what pages have that word on it. So apparently, the way that they actually do this calculation is with somewhere between 5 and 10 MapReduce operations. They take all the web page information, they have it on a bunch of computers, and then they tell all those computers what to do to their own data so that it eventually constructs the index. And it takes 5 to 10 times. They have to send out the data, make it do different things, send some information back, send it out, kind of like churn it. So that's pretty cool. Alright, we can try to do a reduce operation in parallel. Let's see where we are in time. I'm not going to do this demo, but basically, if we wanted to actually sum things up, well, let's do that. Take the first digit of the phone number that you had before. Okay, think of that number. Put up your hands. Everybody put up a hand. And I need you to pair up. So find someone else if your hand is up, find someone else whose hand is up and exchange numbers and add them together. Okay. All right. Then one of you put your hand down. All right. Do you understand what you've done so far? We should have had everybody with hands up. Then everybody should have paired up. Then half the hands should go down. So half the hands should still be up. And you should have the sum of the two numbers. Okay. Now we're going to do it again. What are you talking to me? Just pick a single digit. I just want you to add. Yeah. Take one number. Sorry, one digit. You're right. A number could be many digits. Pick a single digit. Let's try this again. Everybody hands up. Everybody hands up. You have a single digit. I want you to exchange that digit with somebody else.
If you can't find anyone to talk to, just keep your hand up. All right, one of you put your hands down, the other one keep it up. Okay? So I should have half the hands up, and the number you should be thinking of now should be the sum of the two numbers you started with. Repeat this operation. Find someone else. If your hand is up, find someone with a hand up. Exchange numbers. Take the sum. One of you put the hand down. Okay? This is round two. All right? All right. So you basically, if your hand's down, it means you gave your number and your total to someone else. All right. Third round. Do it again. Find someone whose hand is up. Add them up.
25.
All right. You have to decide who's going down. All right. Do it again. Find someone whose hand is up. If your hand is up, sum them up.
I got 51.
That seems impossible, but okay. All right. All right. So one of you hand down. All right. How many hands are still up? Not very many. All right, last round? No, almost last round. Find, if your hand is up, find somebody else whose hand is up. There's one back there.
56.
36.
Okay. So that's 98.
Okay. All right, and is anybody left other than you? See, that makes no sense, because we did five rounds. Only that should mean 32 people, but we have about twice that. So some people didn't really play this game. But what's your total? 90-something. All right, which means if we have 60 people in the class, everyone averaged like 3 for their number, which I also find hard to believe. So some of you didn't play this game properly. But what do I want you to know? What I want you to know, thank you, though, and thanks for those who played and not sure who did today. I want you to think about how many rounds we had to do. All right? Initially, there were N hands in the air, and we just didn't care. Then after that round is done, half of those hands went down, so we were left with N over 2. The third round, we were down to N over 4. The next round, we were down to N over 8. How many rounds before this is all completed? So how many times can you take a number like N and split it in half until you get down to 1?
Log N.
Very good. Yes. This is when log comes up. People were asking me, hey, when do we get log? It seems like it's always quadratic or linear. No, you get log when you get the success of halving. And that's just what we did. And we use that to actually, each round takes about the same amount of time. So the total amount of time it took to do this add up the numbers game was about logarithmic in the size of the class. If we had a whole stadium full of people, there would have been a lot more people, but not that many more rounds, really. Maybe 5 more rounds or 10 more rounds, but not, you know, a million more rounds. So that's the idea of these parallel reduce operators is that you actually combine information in pairs so that you get half as much, where you do basically half the work in each round. All right, now what about query processing? So when you actually type a query at Google, there's thousands, hundreds of thousands of other people typing queries at the same time. How do you all get your information so fast? And this is an example of embarrassing parallelism. So it's embarrassingly parallel because all they have to do is have a whole team of computers, like almost like service operators that are just sitting around waiting for your call. And so your query goes in, and if anybody's available, any of their computers isn't doing something else, it grabs it and takes control and solves your query for you. So thousands of people, the queries are going to thousands of different computers, they're all getting answered very, very quickly because they're all being answered by basically a single computer. So in fact, I think it's a little more complicated than that. I think one kind of takes control of the query and actually uses a team of other computers to get all the search results, but then its job is to gather them all up and present it nice and send it back to you. But they can do all this in parallel because each of you can be assigned to a different computer. There are other things that have been like this. Do people know about SETI at home at all? So SETI is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. So it was started by Carl Sagan and his buddies to try to say, hey, there's all this data coming in off of radio telescopes all across the world. If there are patterns in there that indicate that somewhere way off in some other planet there's somebody doing television broadcasts, the only way we'd know that is if we were actually looking for patterns across lots of frequencies. Right? The reason that your TV can work is because your TV knows what frequencies people broadcast in. If you're trying to make a TV that was going to work for some alien society, and you don't know that society or even know that it exists, you have to look for lots of different patterns across lots of different possible channels. And the thing is that they have all this data, but they don't have enough computer power to actually do the processing. So they came up with this idea of actually turning people's screensavers into little searches for little pattern search engines. And so if you sign up for a SETI at home, whenever your computer goes idle, it goes off the internet and says to the SETI home site, hey, do you have any data that I can work on? I'm doing nothing else. And so the SETI project sends a little packet of unanalyzed data to your computer, which, you know, your computer then goes through and tries to see if there's any patterns. And by and large, for the last, 10 years, the answer's been no for every computer and every pattern and every bandwidth. But you never know. You know, it could be that your computer will be the one to discover, messages from some other world. Yeah, no aliens have been identified at this time. We sort of let you know if it happened. But the advantage here is this is something that's embarrassingly parallel. It's the idea that there's lots of work that has to be done. It's all the same work. It's all independent. But you just need lots of computers working on it at the same time. There's other good examples of highly parallelizable things when movie makers do lots and lots of computer graphics stuff to render big fight scenes or sunrises or whatever they do. They end up assigning a computer to each light ray. So the way that they actually render these pictures, at least in part, is they say, oh, there's a light bulb. It's sending out light rays. They bounce off of things. They change their color in various ways. But then eventually they hit the camera. If you send out lots of light rays, you can get a very detailed image in your simulated camera of your simulated world. But each light ray has to be traced. And so if you have a lot of processors, you have a lot of light rays, they can all be working on some chunk of the image. Weather modeling, like I mentioned before, is very similar. Mailing out phone bills or parallel process of batch of customers, these things can all be done in parallel. All right, it's 5:30. I would like to take you through an example of parallel processing an image. We'll take Stephen Colbert and we'll put him in front of one of the buildings in Rutgers. But I think I'm not going to get started on that now. I think what I'd like to do, if I could, is it's not 10 minutes is not a good chunk of time for anything. At some point, I have to give out, well, maybe I'll let you guys have a thought at it. So at some point, I have to give out these course evaluation-y things, which is not that. Just throwing random pages. Sorry. These course evaluation-y things. Roughly how long do you think it takes to do these?
10 minutes.
20 minutes. Really? Because that would be a bummer, because then I don't ever want to do it. So I can do these next time. Maybe I'll give them out in the beginning of class. That way, in the beginning, when people are sitting and not doing much else, you can work on those. I need a volunteer to actually take them where they need to go. Has anyone done that before? Do you know how to do that? All right, I'll find out a little more about that for next time. What else? Any other questions or comments? I want to get the sample final out. Yeah.
Could you bring me the sample final?
So it's mostly ready, but I really want one more question, and I'm stumped.
UBC codes.
Yeah, no, I want something from the second half. I have first half stuff that's good. Yeah, I've got one on this, which is I give you the tree and you write the codes, and one on this where I give you the word and you have to compress it, see how many bits it is. So I have that. Count what? Maybe. Something big O-ish. All right, so I'll, if I don't have one tonight, I'll send it out with that as a whole, and then we'll fill it in later. So you should at least have that, and try to look at it and know what to do, because then it's the final's easy and you're done, and it's easier for me to grade it. It makes me happy to give you good grades. Let's just all be good about this. Yeah, but just like the setup, same as the midterm. Yeah. Yeah. Same as the midterm.
Thank you.
Why
is
she
going to
bring me
to the band? I don't want to do that. Yeah, why does she? Dear proposer. Hey, see you after one. All right, so this is day 12, one, okay? And then this is 24. Okay, yeah, sorry, I'm trying to get something on the next. Hey!
Is there a way to
To grow a word?
Yeah.
I don't see any way to do that.
Yeah, but I'm trying to.
Yeah, so it looks like they'll let you assign a string. So then the words are usually called strings. You can put a string value into a variable. You can't do anything with it other than say it.
Yeah.
You can't take two strings.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, so there's a lot of languages that will do that.
For
you can just say them one after the other.
Yeah, but
no, it shouldn't have to be.
Because every time I would have to add a line. Because what I did, I put them, the whole verb, like was the 10-word love version.
Yes.
And I put them in a list.
Right.
Made a list, and then I would say, say one. They say, then say one and two. Say one and two, three.
Yeah, but that's cheating too. You really want to have it.
You see, but then it came out to be so long, but if there would be nothing in the accumulator that would be able to do it, that would be listen.
Sure. But. Yeah, you don't have to do that. No. So you have them in you have the words in an array, is that what you said, or you
in a list.
In a list, yes. See.
Like there would be like the 11 verses, but one in each row, verse one is one line, verse two is two
lines. Right, but then all you have to do is have a repeat loop